Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon and we take your phone calls during this hour. If you have questions you'd like to call in with and talk about, questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, or if you have a different outlook on things and disagree with the host on some matter and you want to bring that up for conversation, this is the number to call. Now, by the way, the line's just filled up, so don't call now, but keep this number handy, and in a few minutes, perhaps you can call and get through. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And our first call today is from Tom in Tacoma, Washington. Tom, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. I'm not one to believe there's a demon behind every wish or bad habit or sin, but Apostle Paul has warned us about spiritual warfare. I feel that an army of demons has taken over one of our political parties. It's the party that promotes killing of babies, sexual perversion, Marxist communist ideas, and trying to rid God from our nation and dragging our church members down with it. When I was channel hopping during the presidential election, I found that news people on the mainstream media would repeat the same exact phrases on each news story that was coming up, mostly favoring this party, which was very eerie and very organized. And at the same time, a virus infected our nation just prior to the election with slick advertising, putting fear into people and closing churches, preventing people from worshiping and praying together for God to deliver us from the evil one. And a lot of people are saying, everywhere you go, saying this is the strangest time we have. I got two questions. First of all, am I nuts? I know people that go nuts are probably the last ones that know it. And if I'm correct, what should we do?
Well, I have to say that your observation is not very different from my own in these matters. Let me read you a passage where Jesus was talking about demons in Matthew 12, verses 43 through 45. Jesus said, "When an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places seeking rest and finds none. Then he says, 'I will return to my house from which I came.' And when he comes, he finds it empty and swept and put in order. Then he goes and takes with him seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter and dwell there. And the last state of that man is worse than the first. So shall it be with this wicked generation." Now, at first, Jesus sounds like he's simply giving us a lesson about how demons behave and the danger of a man who's been delivered from demons, perhaps needing to take care that he doesn't become infested again, only worse. But the last line, "so shall it be with this evil generation," means that this story about the demons is an allegory. It's a truth. I mean, demons are real. But the story about a man who's been delivered and gets infested again is an allegory for that generation of Jews that Jesus was speaking to, because Jesus had come and they had demons all over the place. I mean, every town Jesus went to, he cast demons out of people seemingly almost as much as he healed the sick. It seems like the nation had become fairly, possessed in some respects, not as a whole, perhaps, but there were a lot of demonic activity. And what did Jesus do? He spent his time driving demons out of people. And even on the larger scale, he said he had bound the strong man, Satan, and was plundering his house. So we see Israel in that generation was like a man who had demons, but Jesus came and drove them out. But then he said, the demons will come back. And if they find the house empty and simply cleaned up, but not a different inhabitant in the house, they come back in larger numbers. They'll come back in force. He'll bring seven more with him. And of course, the number seven to the Jewish mind just means a total number, a complete number. In other words, the man who has seven demons is a man who's totally demon possessed. And Jesus was saying this was true of Israel in his day, that he had come. He had cleaned house there, as it were, and yet because Israel rejected him, they would be infested with more demonic control and affliction than they had known before, much worse. And this actually did happen. When you read Josephus, you can tell that the Jews, during the time of the Jewish war, just before Israel fell, demons apparently were unleashed on the whole society because everyone was going crazy. There was a lot of murder, which would not have otherwise been practiced, and a lot of perversion, and a lot of persecution of righteousness and so forth. And I mean, whenever you read, anyone who reads the history of the fall of Jerusalem will see that the behavior of the whole society practically was irrational, violent, corrupt, perverted, and all those things. And this is the fulfillment of Jesus' threat, that this nation, his generation, has had the demons driven out of them by Jesus, but they don't receive him. So their house is still uninhabited, and it's vacant for a great number of demons coming. He said that'll happen to this generation, and it certainly did. In fact, this is, in my opinion, what the locust plague in Revelation 11 is describing. The locusts, I believe, are demonic forces. But also in Revelation 20, there is the binding of Satan for 1,000 years. And at the end of it, he's released for a little while. He goes out and deceives the whole world, and he surrounds the beloved city. And I believe, since I'm an amillennialist, and I believe the 1,000 years is symbolic for the age of the church, that the releasing of Satan for a little while is a little period at the very end of the age of the church, where the demons are unleashed in force, where there's one last final test of the world and of the church. And that ends well, although it must be very horrendous during the time that's taking place. It ends well with fire from heaven, which is, I believe, the second coming of Christ, coming and destroying the devil and all those who are on his side. Now, I've just given two examples. One of them has to do with the nation of Israel. One has to do with the whole world, I believe. And it is very possible that this could be a parallel to something that's happened with us. I don't believe that America is mentioned in prophecy, but the principle, Jesus said, when a demon goes out of a man, generically, it goes looking for places, and if it finds the place empty, it comes back with more. I believe this nation has had more Christian influence in it, of a genuine Christian sort, than almost any other nation in modern times. And yet the nation has turned from God, has emptied itself of God. Now, of course, there's Christians here. But it used to be that Christian influence influenced the whole culture, even though there was never a time when America was all Christians, or even probably the majority Christian. Still, the influence of Christianity was sufficient to kind of instill a Christian conscience into the society in general. And it was that way for hundreds of years. But this is the first generation, in my lifetime at least, I don't know of, and that I've read about, where the nation as a whole has officially turned against God. Now, there are some politicians who are still Christians, and there are certainly a lot of citizens that are still Christians, though, as you mentioned, even many of them are being very much compromised. So it looks like it's not just that there's the normal ebb and flow of Christianity in a society, which happens over the centuries. It's rather that, for the very first time, Christianity doesn't even seem to have any cultural impact on the nation. And those who are not on God's side are seeming more and more to be without rational or moral understanding. You mentioned a political party in particular, and I do believe that party is a good example of what we're talking about, but I think there's people in other parties too who are taken in by this too. I don't think it's a partisan thing. It's just that one of the parties has chosen to be the mouthpiece for all these demonic things, murdering babies, sexual perversion normalized, and so forth. So I'm on your side about this, and I think there's actually, I'm not saying that the scriptures predict America and this happening here now, but it does, the scriptures do indicate that a nation that has had special grace given to it and special deliverance through the gospel, but which rejects it, is basically one way that God judges such a nation is by pouring out hordes of demons on them. And that's what, again, in Revelation 11, we see the angel from the bottomless pit opens the pit, and out come these hordes of demonic things that are symbolically described as locusts with scorpion tails and things like that. But anyway, so I'm kind of affirming that I don't think you're crazy. I'm sure there's some people out there think we're both crazy, but honestly, but they believe anyone with a biblical worldview is crazy. And there's even Christians who, although they have a more or less, you know, biblical worldview, they don't really have a very strong awareness or concern about the supernatural. I mean, the churches do not often do not emphasize or instill this. Although some churches, of course, go way too far and become obsessed with the supernatural, and like you said, see a demon under every bush, which is not healthy either.
I appreciate that. I know people that have been members of this party for years or have turned from it and feeling that something's terribly wrong. And
I have a hard time believing that anyone who's really a follower of Jesus and has ever been a part of that party would ever stay in it.
Yeah.
I heard somebody call in on a talk show the other day. I don't remember which one or who it was, but they were saying, I'm a lifelong Democrat. Oops, I gave it away. And he said that, but they said, I don't believe in abortion. I don't believe in, same-sex marriage. I don't believe in confiscation of people's guns and silencing opposition and so forth. And I remember thinking, so what is it about him that makes him a Democrat? I mean, and apparently he's just got some party loyalty, which is certainly inappropriate for Christians to be loyal to a party. I don't belong to any political party. Yeah. We should be loyal to God.
Sounds like he's a Democrat rather than...
Well, maybe so.
I don't know.
But my point was that, if someone says, if someone says they're a Christian, but they don't hold any Christian beliefs, that they don't know what it means to be a Christian. And likewise, if someone says they're a Republican, but they don't hold any Republican beliefs, or a Democrat, and they don't hold any of the, they don't agree with anything on the Democrat platform, then they ought to change what they call themselves.
Yeah. I appreciate the message there. Hopefully people will hear it and people are listening to it will have their churches to open their eyes and start praying that we be delivered from the evil one.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I don't know of any churches that ever had their eyes open and began doing something differently because they listened to this program. But who knows? Maybe. I do hear from pastors who are quite teachable sometimes. But I do hope the whole church will come around.
Yeah. Well, Jesus started off with only 12 people it's spread through the world. So, anyhow,
I'd hate to have to start over. I hate to have to start over with that number again at this point.
I know a lot of people are discouraged. So,
all right. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I appreciate your call. God bless you. Scott from Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. I have a question about blood. There's lots of scripture in like Deuteronomy where it talks about the life is in the blood and don't eat blood and, the blood of Christ cleanses us. God talks about blood a lot, and I don't understand exactly why. Give a short sermon on all that. Okay.
Yeah, I've heard different things, theories about that, but I don't really know why it is that blood specifically is so sacred, except insofar as, like you said, the life of the flesh is in the blood, and therefore blood represents life. Now, of course, probably most of the statements about in Scripture about blood are about human blood and human life, but not all. I mean, the Jews were not allowed to eat the blood of animals either. Even the animals that were clean animals, they were not allowed to eat the blood. But that may simply be because animal blood is, it's awfully close to the idea of human blood, though it's not the same thing. It's not fully explained, in my opinion, it's not fully explained in Scripture. But I do think that apart from the idea of eating blood, the idea is that God considers himself to be the Lord of life, and life is in the blood. And I suppose that blood becomes an emblem of life, and that it's devoted to God. And anyone who sheds human blood has done such an atrocity that the Bible says it can only be atoned for by the shedding of the blood of the person who did the shedding. So, I mean, it's a very, a very sacred thing, especially human blood. And obviously the blood of Christ is a very major focus in many passages in the New Testament, the blood he shed on the cross. And again, I don't know that, I mean, sometimes people talk like there's the blood is like a magic serum or something. It has certain strange powers in it. We actually have hymns that talk about there's power in the blood. Well, I guess there's a power in the blood, but it's the power to cleanse sin. And I think that in the New Testament, the expression the blood of Christ in most cases could be simply referring to the death of Christ, the bloodshed, the shedding of blood of Christ. His death is what atones. And to speak of someone's blood can refer to their death, you know. And I think it does in the New Testament a great deal. So it's simply the connection of blood with life that seems to make it so important. But there are other things associated with life too, like breath, you know. The life is in the blood, but you got to have oxygen too, and other things too. Eventually you have to have water. Interesting how that, you know, the Holy Spirit is likened to both breath and water. But these are things that, you know, they sustain life. And I guess blood is counted as the emblem of the essence of life. But I'm not saying anything very profound here, partly because I don't think the Bible really explains it that thoroughly, apart from the statement that the life of the flesh is in the blood. I think what we extrapolate from that would be the best answer we could seek, you know, to your question.
There is no forgiveness of sin without the shedding of blood. Mm-hmm. So, and can I ask one more? If you got time, you can answer it.
But let me just comment on what you just said. There's no forgiveness of sins without the shedding of blood, because the wages of sin is death, and the shedding of blood means death. So without death, there's no atonement, because the wages of sin is death. So to atone for sins requires the shedding of blood, or the death of a sacrificial victim, which was true in the Old Testament, in the, you know, tabernacle system, and of course now through the blood of Christ. But go on, what was your second point?
Somebody called in yesterday and asked about the pros and cons of Seventh-day Adventists, and I was wondering if you could, if you have time, the pros and cons of Baptist. And I'll hang up if you want to answer that. Have a good day, Steve.
Okay. Thank you for your call. Yeah, I don't necessarily make it my goal to critique specific denominations, but of course people have every right to ask me what I think about certain ones. And I was raised Baptist myself. I was Baptist for my entire upbringing until I came into the Jesus Movement in 1970. When I was 16 years old, and then I was, of course, non-denominational. I was at Calvary Chapel, which was not yet a denomination. Of course, it is now, but at that time, it was only one congregation in Costa Mesa, California. And so, you know, I went to this non-denominational church from the Baptist background. Now, I still had a great appreciation for my Baptist upbringing, and still would hold some of the basic things that make Baptists Baptists. I mean, Baptists, of course, are so called because they believe in what we would call believer baptism rather than paedo baptism. Now, paedo baptism is simply a term that means infant baptism. And so, you know, the older denominations, Catholic, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Wesleyan, Methodist, so forth, Anglican, they all practice paedo baptism, or the baptism of infants. The Baptist movement, you might assume, if you knew church history a little bit, that they would have arisen out of the Anabaptist movement. The Anabaptist movement was the first movement in about 1,300 years to begin baptizing adults instead of infants. The Anabaptists were the ones who didn't believe that infant baptism was of value, and therefore they, even when they had been baptized as infants, they believed that once they became converted, they should be baptized as Christians, since baptism is for Christians, not for non-Christians, which an infant is a non-Christian. So so the Anabaptist movement was kind of the breakthrough movement that began to introduce and were greatly persecuted for practicing believer baptism. That is, only baptizing believers, not babies who aren't believers. And you would think that the Baptists came from that. Well, the Baptist movement actually came by more circuitous route. They obviously got some influence from the Anabaptists, but they came through, I think, the congregational route or something like that. And there were Baptists in England before there were Baptists just about anywhere else. And, of course, they came over to this country also fairly early on. Roger Williams, I think, was one of the main Baptist leaders that came to this country in colonial times. But now there's about 40 or more Baptist denominations, and it's hard to broad brush Baptists. So there are very conservative Baptist denominations and very liberal ones. The most liberal of the Baptist denominations that I'm aware of is called the American Baptist Convention, and there's several that are quite conservative. There's some that are called conservative Baptists. There's some who are called a General Assembly of Regular Baptists. There's some that are called Missionary Baptists. Of course, there's Southern Baptists, which I think is the largest, if I'm not mistaken, the largest denomination in the country. But they all have their own differences. Obviously, these different Baptist groups differ from one another on a scale from the more liberal to the more conservative. The conservative ones pretty much have beliefs that most of us can embrace. They generally do not believe in the continuation of the gifts of the Spirit, which is the main difference that I noticed when I left the Baptist church that I was raised in and went into a non-denominational church where I encountered the reality of the spiritual gifts, more or less a charismatic kind of belief system. And the Baptist churches, some of them are charismatic in their beliefs, but most, generally speaking, are not. Many Baptist groups are Calvinistic, especially groups like the Reformed Baptists. They are Calvinistic. Others are partially Calvinist, they would say. They would say they're three-point Calvinists or something like that. But it really differs. Obviously, one kind of Baptist church would come under different kinds of criticisms than another kind would. There are areas of disagreement I have. I certainly agree with them on the matter of believer baptism. And I don't agree with the ones that are Calvinistic on that point. I don't agree with the rejection of the gifts of the Holy Spirit, which is a doctrine called cessationism. I don't believe it. I don't accept that doctrine. So there are areas of disagreement. But frankly, there are some very good churches, both Baptist and otherwise, that hold such views that I think would be still very good churches to belong to. I don't judge a church on its denomination because very few labels, like the word Methodist or Presbyterian or Lutheran or Baptist or even Mennonite, very few of these labels speak of a monolithic kind of Christian group. All the different denominations now have liberal branches and conservative branches. And even quite apart from whether you're in any particular denomination, the thing that's going to matter most for your spiritual growth and for pleasing God is that the church is a community of loving people who love Jesus and love each other and who really are committed to following Jesus. You'll certainly find those kinds of people in most Baptist churches. But I wouldn't say you'll find any church of any kind where everybody in it is like that. But I would say most Baptist churches I'm aware of would have plenty of people who are true followers of Jesus and who are loving each other. And that would be the thing I'd look for in a church before I'd even consider what denomination it is. I don't care what denomination a church is. I'm interested in a church following Christ's commands. And there are people in all churches, or almost all churches, that fit that description of being good disciples of Jesus. So that would be my short course on the Baptist churches. When we come back from our break, we're going to talk to Alfred from Berlin, Germany, and we have other callers waiting also. So we have another half hour coming up, but at this point in the program, each day I try to let you know that the Narrow Path, which has been on the air now for 23 years, remains on the air only because some people who listen to it think it's worth keeping it on the air and actually, I guess we could say, put their money where their mouth is. We are listener supported. You'll notice if you listen to the program a few days in a row that, hey, I don't hear any commercials. You know, where's the commercial for my pillow? Where's the commercial for Relief Factor? No, we don't actually have any commercials on this program. We just give you an hour of programming, that is, of questions and answers. And therefore, there's no money that comes in from any source except from listeners, if it comes from there. And we stay on the air because we pay for the time on radio stations, which is very expensive. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you may do so. Then the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from the website. Now, the website's loaded with resources that are all free. Everything we offer is free. And yet you can donate there if you want to. It's at thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. You can either just take stuff for free, or you can do so and donate, or just donate. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Please stay tuned.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to study, learn, and enjoy by visiting thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Remember, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls if you'd like to call in with questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, or if you have a different viewpoint from the host and want a balanced comment. We'd be glad to hear from you. Once again, the lines are full, so it doesn't make any sense to call right now, but you can take this number down, and in a few minutes' time, if you call in, I'll bet you'll find a number, a line has opened up. I want to make this, the number is 844-484-5737. I have to make an announcement about this Saturday. Originally, we had planned a rather irregular meeting that we've been doing for years in Buena Park, California, and many of you have attended those meetings, and we had one scheduled for this Saturday night, but we've canceled it for tonight, for this week, I should say. We're not going to be able to do it, and there's a number of reasons for that. One is its proximity to Thanksgiving. A lot of people travel at Thanksgiving, and the other, of course, is the COVID thing. And although we have not stopped having meetings altogether during the COVID thing, but it's one of those things where you always take a chance when you hold a meeting that, you know, someone in law enforcement might think you're doing something that you're not supposed to do, because they don't, you know, a lot of police don't know about the Constitution. That's not really part of our education anymore. So anyway, just no meeting this Saturday. We will announce when we are going to do it again. Alfred from Berlin, Germany. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, Steve. I was just curious as to what you could tell us about QAnon.
You know, I can't tell you anything about QAnon because I don't know anything. I see people mentioning them in their Facebook posts, but I've never had the curiosity, I guess, not enough to look it up. Now, I realize that it's in the common vocabulary of an awful lot of people now, but it's just something I've never looked into. I don't even know what it refers to. That's how ignorant I am about it. What do you know about it?
I know what I've read about at various places, but mm-hmm. I had been curious as to what your take was on it, because
right.
You seem, on some of your other comments, to have assumed that... To have believed the rumors about vote fraud and things like that. So,
well, why shouldn't you? Have you heard the evidence?
I've examined some of it that I can find, and there doesn't seem to be much evidence for that. But it seems like an awful lot of Christians these days are much more susceptible to conspiracy theories than they should be?
Well, it's hard to say. I think that there's been a lot of conspiracy theories against Trump, you know, that he conspired with the Russian government to steal the election in 2016, that he was doing something inappropriate with the Ukraine. I mean, those are conspiracy theories, too. They're just not conspiracy theories that the left objects to. Yeah, a conspiracy theory that places, leftists in the midst of some kind of conspiracy, I think turnabout's fair play. If people are going to have ideas that there are conspiracies against America foisted by Trump, by the way, those were extremely closely examined by all the major agencies of law enforcement in this country and found there was absolutely nothing to them. But from what I understand, there's far more to this voter fraud thing. It may turn out that the evidence can be explained apart from voter fraud, but there's an awful lot that a priori looks like voter fraud, so I think it needs to go to court. And I don't think there's any shame in holding the theory that if there's fishy stuff, that could mean that one of the greatest crimes in the history of the country has been perpetrated. There's certainly nothing wrong with examining that in a court of law. That's exactly where it should be examined. That's where they examined Trump, as it were, and of course he was found innocent. But I don't know anything about QAnon. I don't even know what side they're on. I guess they're considered to be a far right or something, because I say so only because I see people mention it who are on the left, and they're speaking unfavorably. But I don't even know what QAnon means, and I don't know what they stand for, so I can't help you on that. But we know very well that if the shoe is on the other foot, and if Mr. Biden had been winning on election night right up until late night, he was way ahead of Trump, and then the voting precinct stopped counting votes, and then they came back a couple hours later, and suddenly there were hundreds of thousands of new votes for Trump that had appeared out of nowhere. And so that Biden lost a lead that he had the night before of 700,000 votes, you begin to wonder, well, where'd those votes come from that are every one of them for Trump? I'm pretty sure that the Biden campaign would be using every legal remedy to investigate this. So, I can't see why anyone on the Trump side should be embarrassed to do the same thing.
So far, almost all of the court cases that Trump's supporters or legal team have tried to bring to court have been virtually laughed out of the courts by the judges.
Right, that's right. And so that's why...
I don't think those were all...
That's why it needs to go... That's why it needs to go to the Supreme Court, I think, because we know of many lower courts that are totally ideologues against Trump and against the Constitution and things like that. I mean, the courts are supposed to be neutral, but so is the press. And we certainly don't see any neutral press. So we simply can't assume anymore that anyone, even if they wear a judge's robe, has no preferences, and or that person doesn't care about his family's safety or his personal career or her personal career. I mean, judges are people too, and if they feel like, well, if I go this direction, I'm going to have to get bodyguards to watch all my children for the rest of my life, and I'll never get a job if I ever lose this one, because that's the trend. I mean, if someone who doesn't think that says, oh, that's a conspiracy theory, well, I don't consider myself a conspiracy theorist, but I do see what's in front of my eyes, and so do others. So there's definitely a big difference of opinion about this among citizens. I assume you're an American citizen living in Germany.
Yes.
Is that correct? Yeah. I wish I could tell you more about QAnon, because that's what your question was, but I don't. I have zero information.
I'd say I'm more relieved that you can't, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I'm not really part of any political movement at all. And if that's a political group, that would be one of the reasons I don't know. I do know more about a group like Black Lives Matter, because there's been a lot more publicity about them. It's hard to miss that. But I haven't seen that much publicity about QAnon. It seems to be... I almost get the impression it's a conspiracy theory on the left side, but I could be totally wrong. I make no claims to knowing.
Okay. Well, thank you for your opinion.
Okay, Alfred, thank you for yours. God bless you. Okay, Al from Petaluma, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. I called you a couple weeks back, and I had asked you, you know, regarding what you thought the difference was between, you know, New Age and Christianity. You, boy, I know sometimes when people give you answers, you don't fully understand it until something kind of triggers and wakes you up, and you're like, wow, that's what it is. But you had said the occult and New Age was all about self, and Christianity is about denying self. And once I kind of accepted that, I guess I accepted that in a way that was kind of an accident. I all of a sudden had to start taking care of my mom, who almost developed like dementia overnight. And I had to really become selfless. And I realized that all the spirituality that I had been not so much consumed with, but it's part of our everyday culture everywhere, was that New Age stuff that you were talking about.
Yeah. So, and, so you found that you found that you didn't, it wasn't that easy for you to deny yourself when you had to really lay down your life to care for somebody else, right?
No, because I started to see like people like Joel Osteen, these people that get on, like you said, have your best life now. And one of the catchphrases, I don't know if you've noticed, that they like to use right now is what Jesus said in the Bible. He said, I am. And they like to make these little I am confirmations. And it's funny now because now I see it in such a way that it's so subtle and seductive, but it's like it's the furthest thing from Christianity, and I feel
it's the opposite. Yeah, it's exactly the opposite of Christianity. You're right.
Yeah, I feel really ashamed of myself now because I thought that I could incorporate some of that in my faith. I'm just ashamed of myself because of it. I don't know. Sometimes
well, the closest. Down, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say.
Sometimes when you've been down a path that's been wrong, you don't even know. It's like, now what do I believe? I don't know what's right anymore.
Yeah. Well, Jesus is right, and the New Age is wrong because it's totally in disagreement with him. Of course, the New Age, and frankly, every false religion likes to quote Jesus as if he's one of them. Which is interesting. That's another evidence that Jesus is unique, because not every religion wants to incorporate Moses or Krishna, or Muhammad into their religion. But every religion wants to claim Jesus as one of theirs, and that tells you something, that no matter how right or wrong they are about other things, all thoughtful people recognize Jesus is somebody that, you know, belongs in the right religion, and if their religion is going to be right, they've got to have him in it. And the New Age people, of course, try to quote things Jesus said as if he's saying what they say. But you know, anyone who does that is making the same mistake, not really getting to know Jesus by reading the whole gospel, understanding his thoughts in the context of the time he spoke, and so forth. And that takes a little more disciplined study than most people want to do. But I appreciate that you've come to understand that, because that's a very important revelation. The aspect of in the Christian church that is the closest to the mentality of the New Age movement is called the Word of Faith movement. The Word of Faith movement
like
is all
George
about
Meyer and people like
that. Right, and Joel Osteen, people like that. They are Word of Faith people, and it's a group of people who have tried to use the Bible and claim that they have all kinds of promises that enhance their lives, that make them powerful, that exempt them from poverty and sickness and things like that, because they can control it. It's a little bit like the New Age idea. Is it called The Secret? I mean, it used to be
Secret,
in the news all the time.
Yeah,
yeah, which Oprah pushed and stuff like that. Yeah, The Secret. It's very much the same as the New Age. It is the New Age movement, and it's extremely close concept for concept with the Word of Faith movement. I will say this, if you haven't heard it, I have a series of tapes about the Word of Faith movement, at the website at thenarrowpath.com. And under the topical lectures, it's simply called Word of Faith. It's only four lectures, but I think it could be very helpful for you, though it may not be, it won't address all the aspects of the New Age movement. But it, again, it'll talk about those scriptures that people use in the church, the people who are closest to the New Age eras. Hey, I need to take another call, but I appreciate your call, Alan. Thank you for checking back in with us. Let's see, Joe from Fort Worth, Texas. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I listen to you every day for a couple
you.
Years now. Yeah. But hey, me and another brother from church last week, we contracted COVID pneumonia.
Oh, no.
And we're in the hospital. We're not doing too good. And I want to call you, ask you, and your listeners to you can pray for us. So we can recover
yes.
sooner.
Yes. How old are you?
I'm 48.
And has this hit you? It sounds like it's hit you pretty hard.
Yeah, I'm pretty bad over here.
How long have you had COVID now?
Last Monday, I got real sick.
Okay. Is it getting better?
No, not yet. I better start a treatment. I'm not doing good.
Okay, Joe, we'll certainly remember you. And what's your friend's name?
Ruben Cordero.
What's the first name?
Ruben.
Ruben. Okay,
Cordero.
Ruben and Joe. Ruben and Joe from Fort Worth, Texas.
Yes.
All right. Now, there's several thousand people around the country who know about your plight and who will be praying for you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling, Joe. God bless you. We wish you well. Lord, your will be done. You know, it doesn't scare me, the idea that I might get COVID, and it does occur to me that I could easily get it because, I mean, anyone could get it, I suppose, but especially older people like me. And yet, for some reason, it doesn't scare me, but some might say, well, if you got it and it was really bad, it might. Well, it might. I can't, you know, I can't claim to be a pillar of great faith, but I do know that I've never in my adult life ever been afraid to die. There would be some ways of dying I would not like. Anyway, I'm an outsider. I'm a healthy man at this point, and so I can't really tell exactly what it would be like to have pneumonia and COVID simultaneously. It's certainly got to be a very unpleasant and obviously a dangerous situation. So I hope that our listeners will remember Joe and Ruben, who in Fort Worth, Texas, who've requested prayer about their situation, and it is apparently a serious one. Let's talk to Sharon from Mesa, Arizona. Sharon, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I heard a preacher today saying that Satan had a beautiful covering over him and guarded the glory of God. But when he was cast out from heaven because he wanted to be like God, he lost his beautiful covering, and that a woman's uncut hair takes Satan's place to cover the glory of God. And I've never seen that in the Bible.
That sounds like something that some Pentecostal preacher would come up with, partly because, I mean, other denominations can make stuff up out of whole cloth, too, but it just sounds like the kind of thing I'd expect to hear from some, not every Pentecostal preacher, but some Pentecostal preachers could come up with that stuff. No, there's not a word of that in the Bible. The Bible does say, of course, in 1 Corinthians 11, that a woman's hair is her glory, and yet it doesn't connect that with Satan ever having had a covering over him, or with him ever covering the glory of God or anything like that. There's nothing in the Bible about that. The preacher is alluding to some images that are found in Ezekiel 28. Beginning around verse 12, but I don't believe those images have anything to do with Satan. But many people do, and that's where he's getting it from. But even that passage doesn't say what this guy's saying. I mean, that passage does speak of the king of Tyre as an anointed cherub who covered or protected, and it said he was perfect in beauty. And so that's where some of those words are coming from in the preacher's statement. But his statement doesn't resemble the statements even that contain those words in them in Ezekiel. So, I mean, he's, first of all, I think he's making a mistake of identifying the king of Tyre in Ezekiel 28 with Satan. And secondly, he's kind of just reshaping it like silly putty into a totally different kind of...
He was also saying a woman's uncut hair, that the angels could relate to her and would pay special attention to her. But if you had cut hair, that the fallen angels would recognize you.
This is his interpretation of 1 Corinthians 11:10. And 1 Corinthians 11, verses 4 through 16, are talking about long hair on women and short hair in men. And it's, Paul makes quite a few statements that must have been more clear to his original readers than they are to us. For example, he talks about the need for women to have their head covered with a covering. Even though he says their hair is given to them as a covering, he also wants them to wear a veil or a covering over their head. But we don't know exactly what that looked like. Now, there are denominations that try to practice this, that women cover their heads, but some of them just put a little basket on their head. Or, of course, I think Catholic people historically, if women have covered their heads more like a shawl when they go to church. But Paul never even describes what an adequate covering is or why it's to be done. But it was apparently understood more by the people of the culture he was writing to. In any case, there is a statement in his discussion in 1 Corinthians 11:10 where he says that for this reason, a woman ought to have authority on her head because of the angels. Now, that's where your preacher's getting the idea of angels. But Paul does not in any sense elucidate how the angels have anything to do with this. Again, his readers must have had some inside knowledge that made that make more sense to them than it does to us. Now, but some people say that when he says because of the angels, a woman ought to have authority on her head, that he's referring to fallen angels and that he's referring to demons and that demons will attack a woman if she hasn't got her hair long and hasn't got her head covered. Other times, people have said, well, because of the angels means because the angels, know that a woman ought to have her head covered and they are shocked and chagrined to see a woman who doesn't have her head covered. Though, again, nothing in the Bible elsewhere would suggest this. I mean, Paul is obviously writing to people who are familiar with the custom and the reasons for the custom. But at the end of his discussion, verse 16, he says, we don't have any such customs. Neither do the churches of Christ. So Paul is saying this is a local custom for you to deal with. And he's telling them, follow the local custom because it shows reverence to authority. And a woman who doesn't cover her head in the way that the social custom would require is advertising something that she's not under authority. So, I mean, this is all pretty local, and Paul ends the discussion by saying he doesn't have those customs, and he didn't. You know, in that section, in verse 14, says it's a shame for a man to have long hair, but Paul himself, while he was in Corinth, was growing his hair long. He was growing his hair long because he had a Nazarite vow, and he didn't cut his hair until he left. In Acts 18:18, it tells us that Paul shaved his head because of his vow, which is at the end of a Nazarite vow, they'd shave their head. So he'd been growing his hair out while he was there for 18 months. That doesn't make him have girl-length hair, but it certainly makes him have longer hair than the average man. So,
well, that pastor was just taking that Corinthians 11 and tying it into Satan's covering, and I don't know where he got that.
Yeah, he may have made it up, or he may have just gotten it from somebody he respects who made it up, but it certainly is not
right.
In the Bible.
Okay. All right.
Hey, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. I got another call at very little time, and this is from Peter in the UK, so I really want to get him in before we're out of time here. Hi, Peter. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. I'll quickly ask my question. I've listened to your teaching on self in the series Towards Radically Christian Counterculture. My question is, should Christians read self-help books, and in particular, such as Norman Vincent Peale's Power of Positive Thinking, that use scriptures in their content, and should Christians read self-help books?
Well, Norman Vincent Peale and his protege, Schuller, who started the Crystal Cathedral Church in, Garden Grove, California, Robert Schuller became a very famous author too. Both of them were teachers of the power of positive thinking. In fact, that's the name of Norman Vincent Peale's most famous book, is The Power of Positive Thinking. And it was followed by Robert Schuller, who was, as I say, a protege of his. And, you know, these were ministers. These guys were Christian ministers, at least ostensibly. But the idea was certainly not biblical in the sense of saying that if you think positively, good things will happen. Now, certainly the Bible talks about faith. You know, faith can change things, and faith is obviously, we could say, a positive way of thinking, but faith is in God. Faith is not in positive thinking. That if you are a child of God and you have faith in God, then God intervenes for you. It doesn't mean everything you want him to do, he's going to do, because he's not obligated to. But it does mean that all will go well in the end for you, at least, if you have faith in God. You may go through tribulation, you might go through torture, you might even die a martyr, but it'll end up well for you if you have faith in God. Robert Schuller and Norman Vincent Peale's ideas of having positive thoughts were considerably closer, frankly, to the New Age movement we were talking about earlier. It's about controlling reality by having positive thoughts. Like I heard Robert Schuller once say in a sermon that some people in his church had told him that they were expecting a baby and they're hoping for a girl. And he just said, well, think pink, think pink, think pink. And so I guess they did. And then he announced, well, they did have a girl. There was a 50% chance of that happening anyway. But, you know, the idea that you can make your baby be a girl by thinking pink is New Age occultism stuff. It's the power of thought, not the power of God. And so I won't judge these men as to whether they're saved or not, but they certainly were in error. And I would not recommend Norman Vincent Peale's ministry at all. Now, if I was not a Christian, I would certainly recommend being as positive as you can be, because it does seem that when people think positively, often things go better for them, and partly because they're motivated. You know, they think they'll succeed, and they'll do things. If they have a positive attitude and expectation, they'll do things that they won't bother to do if they're negative and don't think it'll do any good. So, I mean, if you have a positive attitude, you're going to be more pleasant to be with. You may get a promotion in your job because your personality would be better than if you're Eeyore, grumpy type of person. So, I mean, I would not deny that thinking positively can get certain results. They don't guarantee them, but I think all things else being equal, a positive attitude is going to probably open doors for people and probably predict for success somewhat better, but not because of any magic that's in positive thinking, but because of what positive thinking does in terms of your motivation and your personality and your likableness and so forth. So, I'm not against positive thinking. What I'm against is the idea that positive thinking is a scriptural concept that if you think positively, then things will turn out positively. I think more scriptural would be to say, if you trust God, then things will turn out for you as God wills. And that's what you would want. It may not be the most positive outcome you can think of in this world. Again, being tortured is not, most people can think of more positive outcomes for their lives of being tortured to death. But many Christians who have a lot of faith in God have experienced that. But they also, because they have faith in God, know that that's not the end of the story. That being tortured to death is never the last chapter of the story for the believer. So it's a very different concept to trust that, you know, positive thinking has magic in it on the one hand, or to believe that trusting God is a good thing to do in the long run. I'm out of time. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Go there and take what you want. It's free. Or you can donate there at thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.